underneath it all is the amount of data, massive, massive amount of data that's in your phone, in these devices, just inside of it. I would love to see the next evolution of that is to have some ways to bring all of these data together in a sphere that I can control, is permissioned, and I can say who is interacting with me can have access to this and can do this for me.
Welcome to Supply Chain Now, the number one voice of supply chain. Join us as we share critical news, key insights, and real supply chain leadership from across the globe, one conversation at a time.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Scott Luton and special guest co-host Bill Huber with you here on Supply Chain Now. Welcome to today's show. Bill, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Scott. It's so good to be back with you and see you and have the opportunity to collaborate with Theo today.
Same, my friend. I've really been looking forward to this one. And Bill, I can't wait to learn from you and our guest. Because, folks, we got a great show teed up. We're going to be talking about all sorts of topics. I think in a many unique topics here on Supply Chain Now. You know, from what global supply chain might learn from the world of fintech to key attributes of those organizations truly moving mountains with AI to the opportunity that fintech innovation poses to supply chain organizations. All that and much, much more. Stay tuned for a fascinating discussion. And, Bill, I'm delighted you could stop by and join us again. It's been too long. I think it's important that our audience knows, though, Bill, you and I were touring the port of Rotterdam last time. I think we were together in person, right?
That's right. That's right. Very great tour with Kenzo from Modis from the Rotterdam Port Center.
That's right. That was an incredible, almost a full day spent, and I really appreciate your facilitation there. But for our audience, folks, y'all might remember Bill from some earlier shows, but I want to remind you of his significant background in the C-suite in global supply chain, especially as a CFO. And I look forward to his insights here today. So, Bill, it begs a question. Are you ready to go, my friend?
I am, Scott. It's, like I say, great to be back together with you. And what a perfect time. I mean, the intersection of everything happening with technology and, you know, be it in finance, be it in supply chain, be it in general operations. I think we'll have an exciting day to talk.
I completely agree. So, folks, stick around for a great conversation. It's going to offer up tons of actual insights by the truckload. Now, as if Bill Huber is not enough, I got another repeat guest and industry dynamo joining us here today as our featured guest. So, our guest today is Theodora Lau, founder of Unconventional Ventures, and a leading voice at really the intersection of AI, fintech, innovation, and inclusion. In fact, American Banker has named Theo one of the top 20 most influential women in fintech. So Theo is a sought-after speaker, writer, and advisor who works with startups, financial institutions, and business leaders to explore how emerging technology can create meaningful impact for both organizations and people. That's the most important part, latter part, people. She's a three-time author, including her latest book, Banking on Artificial Intelligence. She's also the host of the popular One Vision podcast. Go check it out wherever you get your podcasts. But regardless, throughout her work, Theo brings an important perspective especially to the AI conversation, not simply what technology can do, but how we can use it responsibly, inclusively, and for good. So I want to welcome in Theo Lau with Unconventional Ventures. Theo, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me again. Nice to see you and nice to meet you, Bill.
Nice to meet you too.
Well, you know, I was tickled when we started talking about this your latest appearance here, because it's been too long for you as well, Theo. And I was thinking about, okay, who would be an interesting co-host for this conversation? And then Bill was available and we got Theo and Bill, two of my favorite people. So let's dive in. So I want to start, folks, with the fun warm-up question, right? Let's get to know Theo and Bill a bit better. And Theo, we were talking pre-show and we found something in common, which oftentimes humans will do when they take the time to peel back layers of the onion. We got more in common than we think. And we found out that not only you and Bill are fellow Legos fans, but Theo, you started to share kind of how the Legos experience has changed over the years. So tell us more about that.
It has indeed. So my fascination with Lego bricks started when I was young.
Right.
Back when they had the space, the moon sat where with the rockets, the moon station. I remember it was distinctly gray and blue color scheme. And back then, Lego was Lego. Boys and girls play with it. It was Lego. Fast forward to, let's say 15-ish years ago when I had my first child and then my second one, I realized, wait a minute, now there are pink Legos and blue Legos. There's a distinction, which I don't quite understand, but that's besides the point. The price point. The price point of the Lego, I would say the audience of who they're targeting has changed because now you have the little Duplo set, you have the little sets for the kids, but majority of the market, if you walk into a Lego store, are these big sets, 200, right. 300, 400 plus. They're not for kids. They're for adults. So, it begs the question, all right, I mean, it's interesting, but, are we taking some of the fun out from children, from childhood, from creativity?
That is a great question that we're going to have to devote an entire podcast episode to. I think one other thing about Legos before I move over to Bill, Theo, is its foray into the content world and the Lego movies and just how that's become a vibrant component of the Lego engine, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the things that they've been able to do. So if you ask me if I were to have a dream job, my dream job would be to work for Lego. I want to go inside, right? And see how they're thinking about themes, how they create these different products, what tools they use and et cetera, et cetera. I really want to know.
All right. So Lego friends out there, we want to bring y'all onto the show so we can talk about supply chain, a whole bunch more that helps power the Lego experience. Now, Bill, I think you were going to add, before we get to your official question, react to what we're hearing there from Theo.
Well, I mean, and again, Theo's exactly right. And I've had the great pleasure of actually having a conference on Billund, a little island that the Christensen family, the Danish family, had started Lego on.
Wow.
And so it's quite amazing just to be there. But to the point about Lego, I think, a lot of things are getting more personal also. In, for example, my university from the Netherlands actually had an industrious student who went out and got the rights to have a little Lego castle done of the university. And it's Nijrode Business University in Brooklyn, New York. It's named after Brooklyn. I could spend hours just talking about New Amsterdam, but we won't. Anyway, the point is Lego is really getting to, the idea of personalizing things. And I think Theo had also said that her own high school has, a Lego model.
I love
that.
So
it's quite interesting. Very interesting.
It is. All right. So really quick, we could nerd out for a couple hours, Theo, and Bill, and Lego. Really quick, Bill, you've got big news personally. What's the latest with the fam?
Yeah. Well, both of my children had sort of moved and settled in New York City and both doing extremely well. But we're very proud to be Opa and Oma for the first time in July. My daughter had her first baby boy.
That's awesome.
And so, Felix, and we go up, of course we went up the day he was born, just went up immediately, spent a week there, and we'll go up again in about 2 weeks. So, getting up, my wife already went back to help the family. They went to Chicago for a wedding, took the four-week-old baby with them. So Oma went with them too.
Love
but they're bringing up a real city boy.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations to the whole family. And again, I can't tell y'all how really pleased and tickled I am to have Theo and Bill here today on the show. So Theo, we got a lot of questions for you and I cannot wait to hear your takes on each of these here today. And I want to start, sharing a little bit about, Bill's background earlier, but you've got an incredible background as well. And I really want to start with getting you to share a couple of the key roles that you've held in your professional journey that in particular, they've impacted your worldview and your trajectory forward. Tell us more about that, Theo.
Thank you for that. I like to tell people I didn't come from banking. I was not born a banker, so don't hold that against me. But so I spent about 20 years in telecom, building things, tearing systems down, building new systems, a lot of work on the infrastructure layers, looking at data sets across different systems. How do we create a unified layer, if you will, where, you know, different applications can tap from and build out the customer experience from there on. So that, I would say, influenced a lot of my thinking, because there's a lot of similarity if you look at, you know, telecom versus banking. You know, they're both regulated industries. Both has been around forever. There are a lot of legacy systems you need to think about. There's a lot of constraints that we need to also think about when we talk right now. And I know later on we're going to talk about data fragmentation. It was a question and challenge 20 some years ago, and it's still a challenge right now. So, you know, I draw a lot of parallels from that. But then from there on, I also spent 10 years looking at financial services and fintech innovation. And what prompted that was my journey right after telecom. I took a role in innovation at a nonprofit, an NGO in the US, looking squarely at how do we help people live better life as we get older. And so I learned a lot from that. I think I got a much better appreciation of how we can influence people's lives with technology and the role that money plays into it. And that was what prompted me to do everything that I've been doing for the last decade.
Theo, there's so many questions I've got just on that unique background of yours. But Bill, from 20 years in telecom to at least 10 years driving innovation in the nonprofit space and further exploring how humanity at all stages can apply technology in a real beneficial, positive way. A pretty intriguing, unique background. What'd you hear there, Bill?
Yeah, I what I liked the most was where Theo said how it impacts people's lives, because I think that's where technology, for all the right reasons, helps companies be more efficient, you know, economic, take disparate systems and meld them together, have always the one truth so that you have clear data sets. But more importantly, it's how that data is then being used to really, be it consumer facing or, you know, customer as in within your supply chain. But it's that, you know, making people's lives better, which can be done even just through a more efficient way of ultimately getting a product to your front door.
Yeah, well said, Bill. And Theo, one little quick follow-up before I move on to the next one, especially given all of your time in leadership and driving change and improvement in telecommunications. You know, you think about the dial tone. Now, some folks watching or listening, they may have never experienced a dial tone moment, so to speak, because so many homes don't have, you know, traditional phones anymore. But I'll tell you, from like a reliability, a consistency, and it eventually gave way to how all of us that lived through, you know, those decades where it was very common to have a landline in every home. How often did you pick up that receiver and not hear the dial tone, right? We assumed it was always there. It was incredibly reliable. And Theo, do you ever think about, especially given your time in the industry, do you think about what else we wish could be as reliable as dial tone?
Oh, you have a great point. I don't think, you know, we just took it for granted, right? You're home, you pick up the handset. I think the only gripe I would have is before we had the ability to actually have call waiting. Or, you know, you would call someone and all you hear is a busy tone. I'm like, really? And then, you know, they invented call waiting where hear, you can actually jump onto the other line. So that was like, wow, that was earth shattering.
It was. You're so true.
But you know what though? I think that those times, what we didn't appreciate was we're willing to take time.
Yeah.
Life was slower. it's not always about instant gratification. It's not about, like, I always tell kids, like, you know, back when I was watching TV, remember, like, I had to sit in front of the TV set. That was before recording, right? So you had to, like, find the time with the TV guide. You had to sit in front of it, wait patiently for the one time slot your program comes on, and then have to wait another week, God forbid, for the second episode. But now kids are like, just they're scrolling, stream. It's nonstop.
It is interesting to think about, because so many things have advanced since then. But Bill, Bayo is really pulling at my heartstrings, thinking of what it was like in the '80s and nineties growing up as a kid. We may have had it better then. I don't know, Bill, your thoughts.
Oh, you know, better in the sense of perhaps less dependence on the technology today. Example, very quickly, I got a new iPhone yesterday. I mean, sit them next to each other, everything transfers, but then I go to my banking app, I go to my Amex app, I go to my other app. You got to reset up all the Face ID, you know. It's just like, I wanted this to happen right away. So yes, it was simpler back then when, you know, you didn't have these dependencies. Think about it. If we lose our cell phone today, if it drops in the water, it's panic. It's absolute, you know, almost the end of the day. But back then, I lost a bicycle. You know, you walk home, you tell dad, my bicycle's gone. I don't know. And I don't think I parked it somewhere else, but I lost my bike. You know, okay, you got a new bike, but you lose a phone today.
Changes everything.
Everything's there. I mean, I can't get on Delta Airlines without my iPhone, you know?
Well, you know, one last thing you said there, I could dwell on both y'all's responses, but Theo, I loved what you were kind of implying, is that we were perfectly okay back in the day that you're describing, right? I was a kid in the 80s and 90s. We missed things. We missed some calls because we didn't have call waiting. We missed some shows because largely the VCR and figuring out how to program it was rocket science. And that was okay. And, you know, nowadays, what both of you are kind of talking about is, man, we've got to be in constant consumption mode of everything. And we got everything at our fingertips. You know, I'm not sure if we're better or not, but we're not going to solve that today. But Theo, I want to move on, because I want to dive a little deeper into your worldview that you were starting to share with us, right? Starting with your background and some of what we were reminiscing about. So you've spent a lot of time studying, researching, but also driving change and adding your leadership voice at the intersection of fintech, AI, gender equity, inclusion, and a whole bunch more, big intersection. And so when you look at the global business landscape right now, I'm curious, this is not a fair question because there's a longer list of things, but if you were to pick one development that's got your attention, but it doesn't have enough attention from, you know, business leaders and the movers and shakers out there, what comes to mind, Theo?
Oh, a lot. The list is long, but I would say most on topic and what I've been obsessed with the last year is the topic of trust. Trust in the sense of when we see certain technology or we use certain technology, do we trust it, or does trust drive adoption? So I'll give you an example. I think since at least a year and a half ago, there have been a few reports that have come out that track how people from different demographics, different countries are using technology. Do they trust the use of AI in their daily lives? Do they trust the use of AI in businesses? And what's been fascinating to watch is countries in Asia, for example, Indonesia and China, or in LATAM, or in Brazil. The degree of trust in AI is like in the 60-some percent, in the 70-some percent. Whereas when you zoom over and look at the United States, it's in the 30-some percent. It's like half, right? And when I first came across reports like that, I'm like, well, this was interesting. And then different reports have been produced since then. For the last year and a half, I've been tracking produced by different companies in, you know, from different countries, and they all track similarly, is the trust in AI is much higher in certain countries versus the US. US is almost like, you see, you know, if you look at the headlines, right, you see people opposing the data centers. People don't want AI to be used in schools. People don't want AI to be used in businesses. There's almost this resentment, if you will. Or is that fear, right? That leads to the lack of trust. And so that topic, I think it's important to talk about, not to be dismissed, because that drives what is going to happen, not just in the business world, but also in society.
Yep. Theo, Bill, that is a, that needs its own series.
It does.
To explore that. What's your reaction to that, Bill?
Again, I think it's fascinating as we identify AI adoption around the world, but it's not even just AI. Let's just go back 10 years. It's the technology adoption of, you know, online banking and all of the, you know, the European Union, of course, has GDPR, and all of the data, personal information is so protected that it actually drives a higher trust, but actually lower adoption sometimes. You know, I could talk about my family over there, you know, who don't even use the typical, Kroger or a Publix,
right. Like a bonus card or something.
Bonus card. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Bonus cards, because they don't want their data tracked. And I'm like, are you kidding? I get 20% off the next time I buy one because I use the card. So of course I use it all the time. But the point is, the different adoption levels to me are also a relationship to where countries are with governance around new technology. So it's back to GDPR, very strong governance. Today, the AI Act in Europe actually is mandating that boards come out in their, you know, in their guide, in their annual reports, and literally state that they have full trust in the validity of what AI is being used for. And so this is where I think, and again, you're right, I'd love to have another conversation with Theo just on this, that in the US, we seem to be wanting to push things out very quickly. We also have very, very competitive landscape with between the hyperscalers and, you know, the platforms. And then, you know, it is back to a matter of trust. If it's not your entire in-house platform, how reliant is the AI decision drivers for the decision makers? Because the decision makers still have to be the humans, the executives, the managers. And yet they're depending on this, you know, very integrated network of, you know, where does the data reside? What model is actually being used? Are they in control of what other competitive data is going into that model? And so I think it reduces the trust, to Theo's point.
Well, so let me pick up on that. And I think Bill just gave us a podcast, Theo. I want to pick up on that. So Theo, when you think, I'm glad he brought the regulatory measures that we're seeing in other parts of the world, because there's all sorts of takes on that. Theo, do you think that if we, and there are certain states that are developing AI regulatory measures, right? But we still, I don't think we've really seen a nationwide set of legislation get passed. Do you think, how does that factor into, you think, the trust levels or the fear levels, depending on how you look at it, across the world when it comes to AI, you think?
Ooh, that's a multi-layer answer. So a couple of things, right? You're absolutely correct. There are different states that are coming up with their own regulation. It's a result of, because of a lack of federal oversight, right? So we don't really have, on the federal level, says, you know, here's what you can do, cannot do, and here's who's going to be held accountable or not. And because of the lack of that, different states are coming up with their own regulation, which I like and I don't. I like that there is something, but then the problem is now you're creating a cheesecloth with a bunch of different versions and variations of regulations. If you think about from a provider perspective, it's really hard to, you know, figure out what exactly can I provide and what is going to get me into trouble. And so that increases the burden on compliance perspective. That is not ideal. I do think that part of the challenges that we see right now in the United States specifically on pushing back on AI is multi-things. One is we keep seeing on the headline news, you know, every other day, some big tech CEO come out and say, well, you know, AI is going to take over the world. Well, this is going to be doomed. This is going to be bad. And this is why you should only trust me. I think a lot of that is self-serving because a lot of these companies are coming up with their own IPO. So, of course, you know, there's a little bit of an undercurrent to exactly what they're saying, what they're saying. But if you are as a consumer, if you are as a small business owner, you're sitting there, this is all you can see is this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And by the way, they keep laying off people and there's no safety net to catch the people. Then, of course, we're going to feel freaked out. I mean, this is normal human reaction. If you have a sort of a framework built to your point in the UAI Act or some sort of accountability that, no, A, there is a social safety nets that will catch you. You won't just get laid off for no reason. There are programs to retrain, to help you, to support you. And by the way, we are going to hold the bad actors accountable. I think that will go a long way in fostering trust.
I heard a lot of pragmatism. If I said that right, Theo, I heard a lot of practicality in your response there. And Bill, quick reaction before I move forward with Theo, quick reaction to what she's describing there.
I totally agree. Everything she said, it is really about having solutions that are, A, to your word, pragmatic. But, you know, I still reflect on back in the days when we were taking all these disparate systems and bringing them together in one and really implementing the best technology, we were also facing redundancies. But what we did is we took people and did retraining. We made people, you know, more business partners than they were the old, you know, pencil pushers.
Yeah.
And, you know, no disrespect whatsoever to all the roles that people played. I think this is what's going to happen again going forward, but it's very early. And to Theo's point, it is, you know, one threat message after the other, whether it's, you know, Anthropic that's gone out and found out that its own, you know, AI has right. done something quite devious, and yet they caught it. Well, what right. have they not caught? There's the question.
That's good old Pandora's box for this podcast conversation here today. There's so many off ramps we could take. But Theo and Bill, man, so let's do this. Theo, I'm going to continue on and ask this next question, because when you look outside, you know, banking and fintech, even telecommunications, where you spent so much time, and you look at industries such as manufacturing, where Bill spent a bunch of his time, I did as well, logistics, global supply chain, which the way I use that term is it's very inclusive and holistic of all these other sectors, right? Everything is a supply chain. But what innovative lessons do you think that these industries, supply chain, manufacturing, like, could steal in a good way from fintech, whether they're good lessons or bad lessons? Your thoughts, Leo.
I think I'm going to borrow some of the thoughts that Bill just said. It's about, you know, building systems, the silos and all of that, right? In the last, you know, few years, we've seen a lot of movement around open API, around open banking, making sure that we can find ways to get data across each other, to share it, to be interoperable. I think that was a great thing. It's a beautiful thing. I know that, you know, in the US 1033, it isn't really quite right there yet. But in a lot of places, right, open banking is a thing and it keeps evolving into open finance, open data, giving consumers more control of the data, giving them more ways of using the data, giving the FIs and the fintechs more ways to work together. And I think that regulation is good because it gives you access to things that you own, and it gives parties an ability to create and innovate and create solutions that will work for people. So that is a great, great thing. Knowing how to bring data standards together instead of, you know, doing point solutions doing the very painful, boring bits, I call it, the hard work of having a shared, structured data set that is standard. That was a good thing also. So those are things I think is good learning and good things that I love about our industry. The not so good the not so good things is just how you can use data and draw insights and figure out how you can create better solutions for people. You can use it to also exploit people, right? The likes of buy now, pay later, for example. You know, one hand you can call it, you know, giving frictionless credit to people who otherwise don't have it. The other side of it is, I'm looking at my teenagers, like just easier for them to get things without thinking if it's actually something they should get, if it's something that's affordable. So innovation, yes, but innovation on the intent. I think that sometimes we need a little bit of reflecting on who exactly are we helping? Are we helping our own bottom line? Or are we actually doing good for consumers?
Yes. All right, Bill, I can't wait to hear your reaction to the good and the bad that Theo just shared there.
Well, again, I think it's clear that there have been technology advances in other industries, and the slower to adopt, and manufacturing, because it's so, you know, human intense. I mean, it's truly labor intense in so many ways. It's been slower to move. But what we've seen is, again, say the back office, that's where things really evolve first. And then, you know, the marketing side, the consumer side, also, you know, using agentic for just so many things, whether it's, you know, consumer ads no longer are really using an individual that had to be paid, but they're using a, you know, AI generated individual. And that's okay. I mean, that's fine. But what I see is happening now more rapidly. And again, I retired a few years ago, but it was already happening. I know it's still happening in manufacturing, that you really have a lot more of the autonomous robot capabilities. And that actually brings in a safety feature that so many big corporation manufacturers had the biggest problem with in the past. And that was all of the, you know, the claims for workman's comp. I mean, you know, your autonomous robot screwing something in a million times a day,
right?
Never gets that arthritic, you know, problem that has to be, you know, 5 years on workers' comp. I mean, it's just, sorry, but those are bottom line things. But it is actually still, you know, humanistic in that you're able to save people from those problems. And again, I think, you know, we'll see how things work out. But I do think cross-training is going to become an industry of itself.
Yes.
In itself, you know, really getting people better trained to be able to do things that previously were all just so very human labor intensive.
I want to piggyback a bit on what Bill is sharing, and Theo, and go back to the good side of what you are sharing, especially as it relates to open or you said open banking, but I kind of was hearing you kind of touch on mobile banking as well. And of course, the data standards, because I think global supply chain, especially as we continue to try to find new ways of applying modern technology, we're going to draw heavily on what the banking world, despite Bill's, he was talking about earlier as he got a new iPhone and then he had all those updates. Still, on the whole, though, I think the ability we have, especially in certain places in the globe, to do everything and then some, mobile banking wise, I think there's tons and tons of applications for supply chain there. And from a data standardization and protocol creation, I call it, standpoint, I think we've got a lot more work to do, especially to get past the point systems I think both of y'all referenced, so that we can optimize the interoperability and not necessarily take more and more humans out. Although in every industrial revolution, we know jobs are lost, jobs are created, but to get more platforms, apps, bots, you name it, being able to communicate with each other. I mean, imagine that. humans have a hard time communicating each other. Well, machines are displaying some traits of their creators, perhaps. But Theo, react really quick to what me and Bill shared, and then I'm going to move on to more AI.
Think about the world that we had before we had the iPhone, right? So before we had the iPhone, when you actually had to, I still remember this vividly. I had spent a lot of time in Manhattan on projects, and Friday afternoon, trying to get a ride to the airport. Oh my God. And especially when it rains, me trying to get on the street and get a car. Yes, 5 foot. That never worked. It was painful, right? So with iPhone, then came the new industries, right? Came the ride-hailing industries. That was, oh my God, amazing, right? You can just get a ride. You don't have to stand in the rain to try to get down a taxi cab who will yell at you because no one wants to go to JFK on a Friday afternoon. That it was life-changing. It was amazing. And along with that, Scott, you mentioned mobile banking, being able to pay people as you go, wherever you are, being able to get allowances to the kids, being able to split a bill, being able to pay a bill when you're on the road, remembering, oh, rats, you know, my Amex bill is due. All of these things is amazing and it's great. And underneath it all is the amount of data, massive, massive amount of data that's in your phone, in these devices, just inside of you. I would love to see the next evolution of that is to have some ways to bring all of these data together in a sphere that I can control, is permissioned, and I can say who is interacting with me can have access to this and can do this for me. Instead of now all of these app companies, they're all taking, I don't know, whatever it is that they want to do with my data and to what it is that they want to do, right? There was a recent, I believe, a court hearing that talked about how Uber is actively monitoring the battery level of your phones, knowing that if you deplete it to like a really, really low level, chances are they can price gouge you and raise your price because you need a ride. Things like that. Like, I would love for the data to work for me, not for the, you know, service provider.
That's a great example. I mean, think of the hurricane season, which, you know, we fortunately, knock on wood, it's been milder, at least in the U.S. Think of all the talk every time Bill and Theo, the price of generators or bottled water and a lot of the gouging allegations. Theo, you're talking about something very, very similar. In times of need, does the price go up? Does the price go down? Are people taking advantage? So many things to take into consideration in terms of what we can expect, especially as consumers, as we move deeper into the technology era. All right. So for the sake of time, Bill and Theo, you are making my brains work too hard, both of y'all. So let's do this. Let's talk a little more AI, because AI is we're being bombarded both personally, as business leaders, from solution providers, you name it. Lara Cesario joined me here recently, and what she loves to do whenever anyone asks her about AI, she asked the person to define what you mean by AI, and I thought that was a really good step to take. But let me ask you this, Theo, from your purview and your work and how you got your finger on the pulse, what is one thing that separates those organizations that genuinely, truly are transforming with AI, moving mountains, versus those that are just adding AI, I'll call it, as yet one more initiative? What separates the two?
I think the ones that the ones that's more performative is a bad word. Bolting on, I think is the more eloquent way of saying it. Is you don't look at the ones that just bolted on, is you keep the process, whatever it is. Things are broken, the data might not be perfect, and you slap AI on it and hoping that things will move faster. And then you step back 3 months later and wonder why things didn't change. Those types is, you know, if you, I always tell people, if you automate something that's broken, you are just automating the bad things faster. You're not fixing anything. So for the ones that actually make it work, that can make it work, is look at how things are supposed to be. Fix your process, bring the data together, bring the people together, the culture, et cetera, everything that you need to make that work. And then look at, what is my outcome? What am I trying to do, right? And then use technology, apply on it, and make it better. That's where I see genuine change. The one thing I always laugh is, you know, like how a couple of months ago, people were saying, well, you know, we're going to measure how people are using AI in terms of how many tokens they're using.
Right.
We're using more tokens and they must be doing the real work. What happened after when the bill comes? Oops, that might not be the best way of doing it. So there you have it.
So Bill, react to that. One of the things I heard there is outcomes first in a targeted application, making sure we're using the right tools with the right problem. But what'd you hear? Your thoughts, Bill?
Well, Theo is spot on. You know, you can't automate a bad process. You have to literally do the fit gap analysis. You've got to figure out what is it that you want as the end state. So I'm going to go all the way back to, you know, within AI, it's every AI project has to truly have an anticipated outcome, return on investment. What is it? If they just throw money at a problem, they're not going to get the return because they've never really set forward what it is they want to have as a return. And I think one of the key things today, and I read a lot about it, I have a very good colleague from the university in the Netherlands who's written quite a bit about both the AI governance and the AI boardroom and the AI war room, but it's truly about understanding, are you making a company AI ready before you're actually making the executive's decision ready?
Mm.
And so I sort of alluded to it earlier, but the point is, you know, AI shouldn't be that end all be all. It's made a decision. Let's go do it. It still is judgment on the, you know, the operators, the people who truly know and run the business, you know, in any vertical. And so I think, you know, again, to Theo's point, you can't build it and it's going to be the end all be all solution.
Yep. You know, Bill and Theo, I enjoyed a recent webinar conversation with some folks from DataRobot. And one of the points that they had made was, as we evaluate where humans need to stay involved in processes and what we can truly make autonomous. I'm not remember all the their short list of characteristics, but one of them is, if it's not reversible, we might want to keep humans in the loop. But anyway, so Theo, we've been talking a little bit today about some of the differences between some of these industries and sectors, but you know, there's a lot in common, really. If you think of banking and supply chain and these various subsectors, is that legacy technology and fragmented or bad data, it is a universal problem almost no matter what industry you're in. So I want to ask you this. It's kind of touched on some of the things that you and Bill both touched on in your last response. Can AI really overcome, especially all that fragmented data? Can we do good things with bad data? Or do you find companies are truly underestimating the foundational, the hard work they still got to do to get the biggest return out of this golden age of technology that we're in?
I would differentiate between bad data and fragmented data. So fragmented data isn't always bad, but bad data is bad. AI can't fix your bad data. You have to do the hard work. Fragmented data, on the other hand, AI can help with that. It can help orchestrate, you know, different data, you know, unstructured mess, if you will. You know, you have things in emails, you have things in PDF formats, you have things in text, you have everywhere. It's like a spaghetti, and you can bring that together. So AI can do the orchestration part. I think there is also the other part that's challenging, and I think it's across all industry, right? In banking, we have the core, in banks, They can have one core provider. They can have multiple core providers. Getting that data from all of the partners that you cannot control, that part is hard. And that AI can help, but is more than an AI problem. And I fear that we are continuing to walk in that direction, and AI or not. A great example recently in the last half year, we've seen three major banking core providers all coming out with their own announcements says, oh, you know, we're going to be providing AI capabilities to our credit unions and community banks that are banking with us. Then the question become, okay, so if each one of these core provider have some sort of AI capability and you're downstream ticking all of that, A, you are still at the end of the day at the mercy of that core provider providing you the capability. And B, now it adds a whole bunch of question, exactly what are these capabilities and who are these different providers providing and how we can bring them back together. AI can't fix that. So I think at the end of the day, it's a fundamental infrastructure problem. You still need to sit down and do the hard work, draw the spaghetti out, and figure out exactly what is the right way to do it.
Well said. And you made me hungry with a little spaghetti reference at the end. All right. So, Bill, I tend to agree with Theo. And she makes a great distinction between fragmented and bad data as well. What would you hear your response, Bill?
And again, I think it was at the very end where Theo really was saying, you know, it's about the organization. It's the ecosystem. You know, where is the data residing? Back to my point earlier, if you have multiple platforms where the data is and you own the model, you still have to understand how to trust the data coming together into your, you know, internal systems from this larger ecosystem. Mm. And I think that's where it's very interesting that the EU AI Act has literally mandated that the boards will be able to certify that they trust that outcome.
Yeah.
And it's all back to, you know, where's the decision being made? But the last thing in the world we want to see is suddenly a lot of, you know, huge corporate litigation, you know, consumer fraud cases and other things because the data was, to the very first point of Theo's comment, bad data, and they relied on it.
Man, really quick aside, we've spent a lot of a big theme today has been about data. Did y'all see the recent news? Now, by the time this podcast gets published, it might be a couple months back, but I think it was Google that outbid others on buying all the data, the whole enchilada from a now defunct airline. And I think the airline was about $6 billion organization, and Google had acquired all the data, the workflows, you name it. Have you seen this, Theo?
No.
I missed it.
Sorry.
Well, in that case, we'll analyze
it. Must have been Aiken times, and I don't catch the Aiken times.
Well, in that case, we'll analyze it on the next podcast, but it's fascinating. Okay. Y'all got to check that out.
Yeah, sure.
All right, so for the sake of time, Theo, let's talk about some of these projects that you have been driving and that you've got a lot of folks that have enjoyed your now three published books and, of course, the podcast that we referenced earlier. I want to start with the three books, right, Theo? The latest one was, I think I shared it earlier, it is Banking on Artificial Intelligence. And I've made it through the first couple of chapters, Theo. I've got to take it slow because, you know, I'm a little bit slow on the uptake, as a dear friend used to say. But let me ask you this. Since your very first book, right, has there been a development in industry that, especially related to technology, that has caused you to reconsider one of your core beliefs?
It's a tough one. I think I flip back and forth on a couple of things. So one is what we touched on earlier in the beginning is around adoption and trust, and alongside with that, friction and control. So it's super interesting when you look at all of the different fintech apps that's, you know, been made available in the last decade, the different capabilities that banks have extended to users. And now, you know, with the Frontier AI Labs, you know, giving, you know, the ChatGPTs of the world, the Claude, the Perplexity, and all of those things, and consumers actually having access to those tools. And for the first time, they can play with it. They can see what happens to it and the outcome. I think that was fascinating. For the longest time, I always thought, you know, consumers, they want more control of things, which I think is still true for the most part. But the more I see more and more of these tools, I think what we need and want more is less friction. Not no friction. Some friction is good. But having less friction, the ability to not just control who can have access to our data, but to be able to delegate the things that is we don't want to do. For example, you know, keep going to the grocery store and refilling the same thing every other week that I know we always have to get. Those decisions that is mundane.
Yep.
I would like for someone to do that for me. But at the same time, I still want control. So I wouldn't say it's completely changing what I'm thinking or reverting what I'm thinking, but it is getting me deeper into what the layers of onion, if you will.
And that's a Vidalia onion. The best onion out there, right? That's here, found here right here in Georgia. kidding aside, the one of the points you made there, Bill, that I think is really important is not eliminating all friction, not eliminating all tension. Folks, we can't drive improvement and transformation and change how work is done for the better without a little bit of the right friction and tension and heartburn, right? That's a really important point you made there, Theo. But Bill, when you think of, as she was kind of reflecting on her core beliefs and reflecting on, you know, as times have continued to change, your thoughts, Bill?
Well, again, I think to your point, you know, friction is really important because it's the world of debate that, you know, really makes a corporation also, you know, and a family, frankly, you know, have better outcomes, perhaps, in that they've thought through problems.
Yep.
As far as, you know, I go back to the adoption and trust being so important because we're now literally facing, a technology that 20 years ago, I mean, yes, you had some sort of automation going on, but never this idea that this, you know, AI agentic can really write script, that you've got these avatars that, I mean, today on Squawk Box, it was great to see, I don't know if you watch it, but Becky Quick and, you know, they literally had an avatar of her. And I mean, they trained it in no time to speak exactly like her, to know the names of her co-hosts, to know when they started with, you know, CNBC. And I mean, it's just the data's out there. And so, you know, somebody asked a question, the avatars, literally that AI agent in a nanosecond found the data. And so, you know, it to me, that's where it comes down to the adoption and trust also in, you know, having to have a bit of professional skepticism in everything we hear, see, and do. And if it, you know, I get how many emails do we get a day, guys, or text messages that say, your bill's unpaid. Wow. I never bought from you guys, you know?
And who is this?
And block the sender.
But. You know, it is I tell you, a couple things you just shared there reminds me once again, for the millionth time, how exciting of a time it is right now to be living at this moment, right, on the blue marble. But at the same time, how equally as terrifying it can be, right? The wrong message to the wrong text, wrong response to the wrong text, no telling what, you know, the wrong click, the path it leads you down to. When you're going back to the content of the show, you know, how we're able to create, you know, lean on technology to create content and perspectives and opinions and conversations that can inform or misinform folks. It really is an interesting time. All right. So, Theo, we're not going to let you get off just by talking about your books, which, by the way, I think I've got all three of them on my bookshelf. And I think you've autographed at least one of them, Theo. I got to get you another two. Let's talk about your podcast. You've had countless conversations on the One Vision podcast. What is one conversation that you've had that has fundamentally changed the way you think about technology or leadership?
Scott.
That's a tough question.
You asked really hard questions. So I would say one huge one, and I'll tell you why it was important. It was an episode that I had with three of my industry friends on the show. We were doing a mid-year recap. And it was Tiffany from eMarketer. It was Julie Moon from Finovate and Jennifer from JD Powers. And why that particular show was important was because Jennifer White, she came to the show and she shared a number. And that number was 53%. Is according to JD Power back then, a couple of months ago, one of their surveys, 53% of consumers have used at least one of the AI tools that's generally available to ask a financial question. That stat was important because ever since ChatGPT came out, back a few years ago, we were joking, this is silly. You can create a picture of yourself, with three hands and, like an anime version of you. People use it to write emails, marketing campaigns, and, and that has since evolved. But we always thought for the longest time, the area where consumers go ask financial questions, right? What can I do with the money that I have?
Right.
How can I, reduce my exposure? How can I improve credit score? Those things, we always thought that's the holy grail. That's, you always go to your banker, you go to a finance site, or you go ask your close friends, right? But now, consumers are apparently going to these tools that don't have context on their financial outcome, their well-being, who they bank with, etc. They just ask and they take the answers. And that was shocking on multiple levels. One is, wow, if only they know where some of these quote-unquote answers are sourced from. A lot of this from Reddit. Would she go to Reddit and ask a finance question? Yeah. I won't. but they dress it up and wrap it up and make it look so plausible and right. So professional, and consumers gravitate to it. And so the question then become, why do they use these tools? Why don't they go to the channels that, should be more believable? And B, what does that mean to us in the industry? Are we getting a little bit further from consumers? Are we losing the insights of, their lives and what they're thinking about, what they want to do? And more importantly, how should we respond?
All right, Bill. Your thoughts.
A lot to unpack there, but I'll summarize it in those few words, very famous in our day and age: trust and verify. And quite seriously, I'll just use the example of ChatGPT. When I was, still working, and I thought, okay, I'm going to test how to really use this, and I asked questions about my own companies, business results. The trash it threw out was unbelievable. And, so it taught me very early, wow, this is scary. Because if I had used that in a board presentation and been caught, with where did this data come from? Oh, I just asked ChatGPT. I probably wouldn't have stayed much longer. But, the thing is, you don't do that. I am probably a novice in comparison to Theo in my use of, ChatGPT, Claude, Copilot, but I just don't need it as much anymore. But of course, I do all the things that Theo had mentioned, as you get on there and you're looking up what's the best, back brace to use if you got a back problem.
Right.
Man, the data it spits out is unbelievable.
It, Bill, it is. And the point, one of the points y'all both are making that is timeless, but we still, as many of us humans, refuse to practice. Context is so important. It's so important. You don't go to the doctor and you think you've got high blood pressure and the doctor is, I don't know, taking your temperature or giving you an eye chart, right? They die, they do a blood test. They learn your whole family history. They do all the holistic medical evaluation, right?
Sure.
In that context, that might be a terrible example because I didn't make it through medical school, but y'all know what I mean. Yeah. Folks, we got to go. We got to do the pros. We got to make sure, especially these big decisions. Oh my gosh, that we're evaluating them holistically and by using the right criteria. And of course, with those trusted pros, Theo, that you mentioned many of them. But hey, humans have been making mistakes with technology for millennium, and we'll continue to do so. But you know, Theo, kidding aside, I appreciate voices like yours that are trusted voices that continue to give guidance via written form, social, podcasts, you name it. And of course, all of the work that you do. I want to make sure folks know how to connect with you, Theo. How would you suggest they do?
Thank you, first of all, Scott. Always a pleasure to talk to you. They can find me easiest is on LinkedIn. I'm always there all the time. So look me up, Theodora Lau. Or on One Vision Podcast. It's on YouTube and Apple and Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Outstanding. And I want to say, I might get this wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but your popular newsletter, the Financial Pros. Do I have that right?
FinTech Pros, yes.
FinTech Pros. I was that close.
It was close.
Outstanding. Well, Theo, always a pleasure. And Bill, really quick, I'm gonna get your golden takeaway in 1 second. That's going to be the toughest question of the day. But how can folks connect with you, Bill Huber?
Best way to reach me is through LinkedIn as well, and it's simply Bill Huber Atlanta. There's a lot of Bill Hubers out there. I'm not the great artist. I'm not the former linebacker. But,
I didn't know that. I'm going to have to ask chat to give me a rundown of all the Bill Hubers out there. Yeah. But Bill, all that aside, I tell you, we have learned. I always feel so much smarter after spending really a conversation with both of y'all. And Theo has given us so much to think about in this incredible time of 2026 with all the progress, but all the regression in some cases that we're seeing. What is your favorite takeaway from this conversation we've had with Theo?
It just comes down to the simple need for governance around AI, and whether it's a federal or at a state or, you know, maybe some way we end up with a regulatory body that's outside of any of those, but actually industry centric. And I think that's what's going to, again, build the trust, the adoption, remove the fear. But without a really strong governance, it's a challenge.
Yeah, no doubt. Maybe it's not perfectly what you're suggesting, but a digital twin of the United Nations, maybe with a little more industry involved. Who knows? Maybe something like that. But nevertheless, I tell you, this could have easily been a 6-hour podcast, and I had to fight the urge, Theo and Bill, to stay focused because I really enjoyed y'all's perspectives. But we're going to have to leave it here for now. I want to thank you both, starting with Theodora Lau with Unconventional Ventures and the One Vision Podcast. Make sure you go check out her books. Who knows? I'm not going to let any cats out of the bag, but is there a fourth book around the corner, Theo? Okay. I figured.
Excellent.
But Theo, thanks for being here, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Keep doing fighting a good fight. And Bill Huber, always a pleasure to collaborate with you. I tell you, I think Bill killed it as his first co-host gig here at Supply Chain Now. Do you think? You agree with me, Theo?
It's amazing. Yes. And we should do this again.
We got it.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Absolutely.
Bill, thanks
for
being
here. More to come,
here.
Scott. Thank you to all of the Supply Chain Now team.
You got it. Folks, to our SC and Global fam, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. As I promised, this is a This was a more of a unique conversation than all the ones that are so focused on global supply chain. And I thought it was a timely and a highly relevant and a consequential conversation. So hope you enjoyed it. But you know the homework. You got to take one thing you heard here from Theo and Bill. They shared a ton of actual perspective that hopefully makes you think, but also hopefully makes you take action. Share it, do something with it. Deeds, not words. That's how we're going to keep transforming the globe and leave no one behind. And with that said, on behalf of the entire team here at Supply Chain Now, Scott Luton challenging you to do good, give forward, be the change that's needed. And we'll see you next time right back here on Supply Chain Now. Thanks, everybody.
Join the Supply Chain Now community for more supply chain perspectives, news, and innovation. Check out supplychainnow.com, subscribe to Supply Chain Now on YouTube, and follow and listen to Supply Chain Now wherever you get your podcasts.